Happy New Year. I hope your 2020 is starting off with a bang. Thank you for listening to Author Stories through 2019 and all of the previous years. We had an amazing year last year and looking forward to doing bigger and better things this year. Before we get into the interview, we're going to thank a couple of sponsors who make the show possible. Please give them a shout out and look them up on Amazon and make sure that you tell them that you appreciate their sponsorship of Author Stories. At the end of the show, we're going to have an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War. This audio clip is narrated by the one and only Luke Daniels. You're going to love this series. I love it so much. And Richard has been a great supporter and sponsor of the show, and we're going to show him some love. Listen to the audiobook excerpt. You're going to love it, and be sure to go to audible.com to purchase it. If you're not an Audible subscriber, you can get a free book just by signing up for a free trial at audibletrial.com/Hank. You get a 30-day free trial. You get the free book. If you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, you get to keep the free book, and it doesn't cost you a single penny. audibletrial.com/Hank, and listen after the show for the clip from Richard Fox.
We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters. That's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. PicosHouse.com/newsletters. Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC, without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today. Visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Who Wants to Love a Billionaire? Billionaires in New York, Book 1 by Laura Burton. Julie does not love being the center of attention. She makes dresses for those who do. But when Emily, her matchmaking friend, begs for a favor, Julie can't say no. It was supposed to be just one date. She never expected to kiss the guy, then fall head over heels for him. When threats start rolling in, it becomes clear someone will do whatever it takes to break them apart. Now she's in too deep, and walking away isn't an option. But with the paparazzi and drama involved, Julie cannot help but wonder, who wants to love a billionaire? Hollywood producer Harry Jackson is not an alpha male. He's goofy, sensitive, and will move mountains to make everyone happy. In fact, he requires a whole team of people to keep him from being robbed blind. Sometimes he even needs saving from his love of bad puns. But when an enemy threatens to jeopardize his chance at love, it's time to step up and fight. He's terrified, but the thought of losing Julie scares him more. Pick up Who Wants to Love a Billionaire? The Billionaires in New York, Book 1 by Laura Burton. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Maureen Johnson on the show with me. Today, she has a brand new book that's out everywhere today when we're recording this, and it's called The Hand on the Wall. It is the final chapter in the Truly Devious Mystery series. And what a great way to wrap up this series, Maureen. I love it, and I'm excited to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Maureen, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I don't remember the time that I wanted to do it. I feel like it was always there. I just was always, I remember these particular tablets of paper that we had at home, like the shape, they would be completely blank. Like they didn't have lines on them. And I was always doodling and writing little stories on them and then stapling them together. I guess I was always making those.
I've heard that from so many people that, you know, there's just this innate thing that stories are just living and, you know, why don't I get to do it too? And it's just a natural thing. Were you a bookish kid?
Oh, yes. I was definitely the kid that was reading and not really doing very much else. I was a very indoor child, like a lot of us. So,
yeah. Did you come from a storytelling family? Was this something that you observed from your parents or grandparents or, you know, other family members around?
I think that, you know, my family wasn't a literary family, but my mother read a lot. And my father weirdly does not read at all. Like he has a no reading policy, which is very strange. We always told stories around the table and the same ones over and over again. And it was frequently relatives that were aggrieved telling stories of the various people that had aggrieved them. So it was a lot of family grievances being aired in more and more dramatic ways constantly and with repetition and getting bigger. And then I think I saw how you honed the story to make sure that it sounds like you were maximally aggrieved by the relative.
I love that. You know, there's a great, you know, oral storytelling tradition that begins around the kitchen table for a lot of people. And, with our increasingly busy schedules, I hope that that's not something that is, that's lost with these newer generations.
Yeah, it was a lot of, my grandmother used to sit at her kitchen table. That was sort of her office. She had a pot of coffee on at all times. And because of the time, she smoked like everybody else. So she had an ashtray, her cigarettes, her pile of newspapers, and her coffee pot. And people would kind of come and sit and, you know, talk. Like it was the phone was there. And then people would come in and out and sit and talk and come in for coffee, complain about the other relatives at the office that, you know, that was run by. It was a lot of people coming over for coffee, complaining about other relatives in increasingly elaborate terms, leaving again. And that was just it sounds grim, but it was actually very, very enjoyable.
And she just kind of held court there at the kitchen table?
The whole family did that. She would hold court, but the holding court at kitchen tables, it was a court of kitchen tables. A lot of just people meeting and going to everyone else's kitchens or, you know, sitting around and doing their coffee and their smoking. And I would listen to a lot of it. And even as a little kid, I would participate because I was an only child. So I would just sit down, even though I was five, just chime in. So.
I love it. After making those initial, booklets that you did, what was your first serious pursuit into making stories of your own and writing them down?
Well, I was always doing it, but I was really confused as to how you got to be from where I was, some random kid in suburban Philadelphia, and someone who published a book. It was an unfathomable leap, and there was no internet to give you any glimpse of how this happened. And I have a lot of good teachers who put a lot of stuff in my hands, you know, about writers and writing, but there wasn't that much. I mean, I really felt like when I decided this is what I wanted to do, it was like I had a blindfold on and was walking to the edge of a diving board and jumping in because I really didn't know how it happened. But I said, this is what I do, so I guess I'll figure it out. And so I just did. I mean, I was always writing stories. I was always usually to the detriment of something else. I remember quite vividly doing it a lot in trigonometry class. like whenever I was supposed to be doing something else, that was usually when I was writing something. Yeah, kind of just constantly writing, because I knew it required a lot of practice. So I used to set a lot of ambitious goals for myself of writing, rewriting, my own personal writing challenges. You know, I when I graduated college, I knew I was going to go to grad school for writing and theater. That was the hope. But I got a day job and I just sat there writing all day long. And then I would write on the train there. I would write. And then I worked at a theater at night, and I did these crazy things where I would write like 10 hours a day just because just practice, like relentlessly, grindingly practicing.
Wow. Do you look back on those times with fondness of, you know, the grinding days of, you know, getting words out? And do you feel like that time was important to make you into the writer that you are now?
Yeah, I worked really hard at it. And it, truthfully, like I almost wish that I was doing the amount of writing then that I am now, but I was so good. I'm going to do this. You know, because if I don't, there's no other plan. So I have to make this work. So it was what I wanted. So I said, in order to get it done, I just have to keep doing this. And that is so much of what writing is writing a lot, because not everything you do works, and pretty much everything you start off doing is not going to be very good. So it's a lot of not everything you write down is going to be, you know, it's not a finished product. So it's a behavior. It's a, you know, it really is a behavior that you have to cultivate.
So what was the first book because you were constantly writing, and I'm assuming that you're like the rest of us and have, you know, one or two desk drawer novels that didn't get published or not published yet. What was the first story that you wrote that did get published? And did you know that there was something special about that particular one?
Well, it was a little weird how it worked for me, because I was in grad school. I was at Columbia in the writing department. So I went to Columbia for two graduate programs almost simultaneously, which is ridiculous. But I was in theater department and I was in the writing department. I have an MFA in writing from there, and I have most of my MFA in theater. And I was working on my class pieces, my essays. I was a nonfiction student, and I didn't know that my roommate, who had gotten a job at a literary agency, was showing my work to the agents, because I was ready. I was thinking I was a year out from presenting something to the world, but they were kind of following me. And so I kind of got tapped to try to do a YA book. So I was asked to come up with something, and I said, well, I can't do that. I don't know anything about young adult writing. I spent all of my teenage years pretty much locked indoors. You know, but I'll show you how bad I'll be at it. And I started to write something, and that turned into the first novel that I had published, which is called The Key to Golden Firebird in 2004.
Wow. What, when you got in and started writing the book, did you feel like that YA voice came natural to you, or did it feel stilted the whole time, like you anticipated that it would?
No, because I just wrote the way I would normally. I mean, and also I think I realized pretty early on that what my experiences were of, as I went to an all girls Catholic high school that was inside of I'm not even Catholic. Like I was never allowed to do anything. So there's this kind of, again, this grievance, and writing because of a grievance is not a bad place to start. I find grievances to be hilarious a lot of the time. So, you know, especially like the kind of family grievances that our family had, they're all really stupid. So coming from that place of like, which is a lot of what being a teenager is about, is actually a kind of a perfect place to start.
That's amazing. How long did it take you to write that first book?
As I remember it, it would have been maybe about a year. It was just under a year. It probably was started in 2003.
Gotcha.
Because I know it came out in 2004.
And you were writing from the best possible circumstance with an audience there kind of waiting to see what you came up with. That had to be nerve-wracking and exciting at the same time.
Well, not really, because I didn't know what was going to happen to this book. There was basically no social media. So that there's nothing. You're going out again into a void. And it was very early on in YA. So I had zero idea about anything in publishing. So I had zero idea how publishing worked, because writing and publishing are two very different things. And my MFA program didn't teach us anything about publishing. So I had zero idea of how it was going to go out. I didn't know anything about it. There was no social media platform. I had no audience. I was just some rando, you know, like all of us start out, you know, and just a book. And I didn't even know, I didn't know what to ask for or to find out what was happening. So I just kind of shrugged and was like, well, I got a book out. I don't know what happens now. You know, there was no tour. There was no nothing. So I was just kind of like, well, I did it now. But the thing was, when I signed the contract, I actually got signed up for 5 books at 2 different publishers. I mean, it really did happen in a very strange way. So I knew I was going to keep writing. And I found out as I wrote, I was several books in, as I found out basically what was going on. So it's not I don't really think it's a bad way to do it. There is just a lot more information now about how things work. But I just didn't have any information.
Wow. Over your writing career, you've written mostly for YA readers. But you're the kind of subgenres of YA. You've kind of, you know, dipped into several different ones. What drives you to try different genre or to tell different kinds of stories? When you begin to think about a new project, you're like, well, this one's going to be a mystery, and I know it's going to be a mystery because I have this idea, or this one is going to be more, you know, kind of urban fantasy or whatever. Do you think about those things in the beginning of a project?
Well, the first 3 books I wrote were The Keys of Golden Firebird, The Ruinous Triangle, and 13 Little Blue Envelopes were all kind of contemporary realistic fiction. And the 4th book I wrote was called Devilish, which is about a girl realizing that her Catholic school is controlled by a demon has turned up and convinced her best friend to make a pact with the devil. And that came about because I was talking to one of my editors, and I started the kitchen table kind of thing, regaling her with many strange stories of what my life was like at my Catholic school. And she was like, well, next book has to be about this. And I thought about it, and I was like, well, what if it was, I didn't think that was interesting enough, but I was like, but what would make it make sense is if there was some sort of demon cult involved. So I just started, I sometimes find that I end up doing things because something has kind of bothered me, or I was like, but what if it doesn't make sense that way? I have to flip it around and do it this way. I wrote a book about there's the Shades of London series, which I created, which has to do with police force in London that fights basically a ghost and the undead. Was because my husband's English, I spent a lot of time in England, and I got really tired of a bunch of lame ghost stories that I was hearing about how ghosts came and made cold spots in the room. And I'm like, first of all, there are no ghosts. But second of all, if you're going to ghost, you know, I don't want to hear about this cold stuff where there's a creaking noise. No. If you're going to ghost, then you're going to ghost. So that's how a lot of my stuff comes about. I was like, what if I just did it this way?
And I love that that bit of imagination to take a real world thing and then just let your imagination go crazy with, well, what could be the thing behind the thing? And you know, a lot of times it just starts unfolding and those stories kind of tell themselves in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's more fun to do it this way. But now I'm writing I finally decided to write the thing that I was so passionate about as a kid. I was a mystery reader. I'm a mystery person all the way down. That was
what I
read.
I was going to ask you what your introduction to mysteries was.
Oh, that was all I read as a kid, pretty much. I mean, I read everything I got my hands on, but I was and I still am an obsessive. Absolutely, like, didn't go outside, 2 Agatha Christies a day. Like, I wanted to solve crimes. I was, you know, I was always kind of sniffing around, like, there must be a crime here for me to solve. That was what I was and am. And I had never done it. And I think because I liked it so much that I thought I couldn't make them. They were just there for me to read. And then I thought, well, that's stupid. Why don't I do one? But I think that sometimes we do that. I think sometimes we're like, well, I love that, so I'm not going to make that. That's for me to take in.
Right. Well, in reading your mystery series, you can tell that you are an Agatha Christie fan. There's so many of those little, I don't even know what you call them, little Christie-isms. It's absolutely your story, and it's got your fingerprints all over it. But you can tell the things that you cut your teeth on, and I love that so much. Are there any inherent challenges to telling, you know, an Agatha Christie type mystery with a YA cast?
Not really, because the thing about all those, and Agatha Christie gets kind of, it ends up being a blanket name for classic mystery, for which was a giant, giant, giant category of reading. Like, it was really from like the 20s to the 40s, there was this absolutely massive amount of classic crime fiction that was being written. That's kind of what we think of as a classic mystery. And I'm happy to say that a lot of it is being brought back by the British Library, who are republishing all of these titles that long went out of print. And it's not really, because it's very contained. It's very, the world in a lot of those mysteries, they have to be kind of small, because you need to see all the players and you need to get a good sense of the landscape, because you need to be introduced to the person who did it, plus all the possibles, plus all the potential victims. You have to know the lay of the land and the rules. And that maps on pretty well to YA life, school, circle of friends, your town. You know, those things actually work pretty well. And a lot of times there's an amateur sleuth, which also works pretty well, because, you know, you're not going to be 16 and a 10-year veteran of the homicide squad. So, you know, that all works out pretty well. And they are puzzles. At heart, they are puzzles. And it's not about the classic mysteries, because there's like a hard-boiled mystery, a noir mystery, which is about the grittiness of it, or police procedural. But these kind of murder mysteries are about the game of it. It's, you know, exactly as Sherlock says, the game is afoot. You know, it's about giving you a chance to work it out.
Yeah. Well, and as far as, you know, characters for a mystery, there's nothing better than some nosy, busybody kids. You know, that's that kind of fall right into the situation. It's a lot of fun. Tell us about Ellingham Academy. Why did you create this setting, and what was the process of kind of building the lore of this place?
The Ellingham Academy in the book is a school in Vermont in the mountains that was created the construction started in the early 1930s, and it was completed, the first class goes in 1935. And it was made by a man named Albert Ellingham, who was one of America's great tycoons. He owned newspapers, he owned a movie studio. He was this incredibly rich man. And he was very eccentric and kind of fun-loving. He was obsessed with games and puzzles. And he decided he wanted to make a place where learning was a game. And he found this spot up in the mountains of Vermont, and he thought it was perfect and beautiful and fresh, and that he could make something there. He could kind of make his little empire. and make it an experiment. So he decides to construct this school on the side of a mountain. He blasts surfaces with dynamite. He brings in construction. He makes this beautiful house for his family to live in. He's got a wife and a daughter. You hear some LA sirens in the background to give this story a little bit of exciting background. And why the 30? So one of the things that runs throughout the Truly Devious Stories is that it's about this girl who's trying to solve a great cold case, one of the great American mysteries, which is what happened to Albert Ellingham's daughter and wife and a student at the school, because what happens in 1936 is his daughter and his wife get kidnapped. His wife is murdered. His daughter disappears. And a student at the school named Dottie Epstein is also murdered. And there is this ransom letter that came in the form of a very macabre poem that was signed by someone named Truly Devious. And so she's trying to solve this decades-old cold case that no one has ever solved. Like, it's a ridiculous thing that she wants to do. Everyone's like, oh, you're going to solve Truly. It's like saying, I'm going to go find Jack the Ripper. Like, no, you're not. Like, it's not a thing, but she believes that she can do it. The school was really bespoke. I knew what I needed for the murder. So it was like I dream constructed a thing where I was like, everything was built to purpose. So there's tunnels, there's blinds, there's alleys, there's statuary, there's everything I knew that I needed. I scripted in. I drew a map. So there's a map that comes with the book that you actually, you can see the layout of the campus where all the buildings are. I did a lot of kind of calculating distances between buildings and depths. And so, yeah, I tend to do this. I love a tunnel. Shades of London series has a lot of tunnels in it as well. I think I just love tunnels.
So you've got this great setting. You've got a bit of, and yeah, that map, by the way, is amazing. Right inside the front cover, and really gives you a scope of the story and where you're going. But you've got this great setting. You've got this built-in cold case mystery and this air of mystery that still hangs over the place. And like, there was this tragedy that happened before, but as you're reading, you kind of get this feeling like it could happen again at any time. And so we've got this built-in mystery and this kind of atmosphere that's pregnant with mystery. And then we've got Stevie. Tell us about the characters and how they come into the story.
Well, in order to have what I wanted was a detective novel. So I had to have, which is a very specific, it's not just a mystery. I needed a detective. So I needed to create Ellingham in a way that supported the creation of a girl detective this detective. So the way that Ellingham is structured, which is it's free to go. You just have to write in, you have to just apply to them. There's no requirements. You just get in touch, say, here's why I want to go. Here's my interest. Here's what I do. And they select a class. And it drives people nuts because it's not like, here's my grades. Here's my money. Here's that. They don't have a known admissions criteria. So she is, her thing is mysteries, true crime, very much me as a child. This is her interest. This is her love. And the school was also slightly built around her to make this possible for her to solve these cases. It really was a bespoke school. She has, her classmates all have a specific interest or skill or something about them. For example, there's Nate Fisher, who lives upstairs, who wrote a novel that ended up getting published when he was 15, and everyone always wants the sequel, and he is panicking all the time because he's supposed to write the sequel to this book that he didn't really know how he wrote the first one to begin with. So he's constantly on the run from having to write and panicking and worrying and basically not trying to not come out. And so quite relatable. Her best friend, Janelle Franklin, is a maker. She can basically make anything. She specifically is very interested in robotics. But she also can kind of craft and create. She just likes to make things, especially, and she's trying to win a nationwide high school Rube Goldberg competition. There's a lot of students, and they all have a skill. And Stevie frequently feels a little intimidated, or like feels like her skill is lesser and not a real skill, because detective is not a skill. Like making a robot is a skill. Writing a book is a skill. Playing a piano is a skill. And she's like, my skill is detective. And so she's very self-conscious.
In the writing of a series like this, Maureen, you've got the setting, you've got the mystery, you've got the characters, and you know that this is going to be a trilogy. What are some of the challenges of planning out an arc that's going to cover three books, give a satisfying ending for, you know, the first two, yet keep driving forward to the ultimate mystery that'll be revealed at the end? What are some of the, you know, from the beginning, what are some of the challenges that you face in coming up with a series like this?
You got to make the plan and live the plan. You really have to get a lot of stuff down before you start, and you have to stick to it. So the first thing I did was write all the solutions, and they were in a file on my computer. And because mysteries start at the end, they start with the why, the what, the how, the, and all of the things that surrounded that event are the clue. You know, the core event is in the center, and then all the stuff we read in the mystery story is the stuff that sort of flew off of it, as if a hurricane blew bits off of it, and in increasing trails of like debris fields that spread out now and out. And you start pretty far out when you find like a piece of paper, a feather, you know, a footprint. And as you get closer, you find more and more and more as you get closer to the central event. So I had to plan out, I had to know exactly who and why and how. And I had to map everything out very carefully. I had to know, literally map, you know, the school, the rule set. Each book, I know I did vary some stuff along the way in terms of character development, in terms of individual sort of smaller events that happened, but this really was about planning. And because there are two timelines, there's a 1930s timeline and there's a present day timeline, and they start off very separate and then they interweave and they get closer and closer towards the end. So there's a lot of, I'm going to say, just planning, investment in post-it notes, a lot of staring at the wall. I have a big whiteboard in my office. But I had to commit early because you can't, a lot of novels, you can change what you want to do or kind of pants it or whatever. This had to be like, this is what happens. So I had to plan an arc in which you got a satisfying piece of it with each book, but then you got, as you went on, you got the whole thing.
In having a series that's this meticulously planned, and it shows in the book, I mean, you know, why it's handled that way. But in the writing, when you kind of get in the moment with characters and they're, you know, revealing character traits and all of this stuff that happens when you're writing characters, do you ever have a situation where one of the characters gets smarter than you and takes a left turn when you had them planned to go over here?
Well, yeah, I think you always have that. The trouble with the mystery is that you then have to check everything to make sure that nothing is, that you aren't going to mess up anything that has to happen. But occasionally what happened was they would say something that was obviously more subconsciously me going, ah, actually, that's a really, like, that's useful that that happened. So that would happen more than the other way around. I would be like, ah, actually, I'll keep that because that's actually pretty, my brain was doing some math at night, so that's good. And that character will do that now, so.
These books are YA in category, but I had so much fun reading these books, and you know, yay. thank God for series like Harry Potter and some different YA books that really opened up the idea that you know, these books can be enjoyed by everyone. Do those kind of things ever, do you think about those when you're writing that you know, this is primarily geared toward a YA audience, or is it that, you know, just the characters are in this YA framework, but I'm really writing this for everyone, or is it something that you even think about?
I don't really, honestly, YA books are just books, and the characters are at a certain age. That's generally the characterization. One of my favorite books growing up was The Westing Game, and I reread it fairly regularly, and it still thrills me. I just love that book. That is a middle grade book, and it's a perfect book as far as I'm concerned. There's a reason people love The Westing Game, and that's a lot of what I thought about was, this should be fun for everyone. It is a puzzle. Like, it's supposed to be a puzzle.
Exactly. The new book, The Hand on the Wall, Truly Devious Book 3, is out everywhere now in hardcover, audiobook, and Kindle edition. However you read books, it's available now. Maureen, if people are just learning about you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you're doing and connect with you, is there a place where they can do that online?
Yeah, I'm at MaureenJohnsonBooks.com. I'm on Twitter as just Maureen Johnson, or Instagram at Maureen Johnson Books.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to see you and to pick up their copy of the whole Truly Devious trilogy, because you've got to start at the beginning.
Yeah, you really do have to start at the beginning. It will make no sense if you start at the end.
And I know you were encouraging people that have been following along with the series to go back and read books 1 and 2 and make notes of the clues that they've collected so far. That has to be such a joy. As a writer, to see people going on that journey of discovery.
Oh, people have sent me pictures of their notebooks. Some people had spreadsheets, or like just little walls of notes, and like where they've made a digital corkboard of little cards and things. Oh, it's amazing. Amazing.
So much fun. Well, we're going to send everyone to pick up the whole series and to get into this. Maureen, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Oh, thank you.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. Humanity's only hope of survival entered the solar system at nearly the speed of light. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information, and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course, wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class, he thought.
Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app? He thought.
Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?
You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right. Doc.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
He asked.
You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen, the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa.
Come. Now. Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to his ear, Mark stopped and looked around before deciding how to continue. Spiked ocotillo plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
"You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?"
he asked the mysterious caller. "You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire?" the caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
"If you're so close, why can't I see you?"
he asked. He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow paddy.